From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Claude Monet found a new way to look at the world, to let his paintings reflect his own impression of what he saw, Impressionism. But those impressions were not drawn from thin air. Among the most famous were paintings of his own gardens at Giverny, water lilies, weeping willows, sunflowers, salvia, lantanas, cascading and serene. Art on the canvas and on the ground. This hour on Point, the gardens, the flowers of Monet. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is Paul Tucker, professor of art at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Time magazine calls him one of America's foremost authorities on Claude Monet and Impressionism. He has curated Monet exhibits across the world, including the current one at New York Botanical Gardens. It is Monet's Garden. Paul Tucker, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Delighted to be with you.
And with us from New York is Derek Fell, writer, photographer, gardener, and landscape designer. He returns to Monet's Giverny Garden each year to update their official calendar. His books include The Magic of Monet's Garden and The Impressionist Garden. He writes the Avant Gardener newsletter. Love that name. His own gardens are at Cedar Ridge Farm in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Derek Fell, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
There's a lot we want to learn this hour. But, Paul, maybe you could help us out just first with a little history here about how this painter, this famous painter, Impressionist Monet, also became a gardener. I mean, which came first here, the painting, the gardening? How's it fit together?
Well, it is true that he was an absolutely passionate horticulturalist, but he was an artist first. He began as a youth, apparently an extraordinary draftsman. We know that from a brand new diary that was found from a friend. But he had a passion for nature that just ran through his entire being. And we began expressing it really in the 1850s when he was a teenager. And then it really crescendo when he was able to purchase this property in Giverny in 1890 and establish those two fantastic gardens, the flower garden and the water garden.
And what do you mean by establish? I mean, did he really build them from the ground up? Were there gardens there?
He built them straight from the ground up, right out of the roots of the Norman soil. Because when he bought the house in 1890, he really had purchased a traditional Norman kitchen garden with fruits and vegetables and the like. And while he always preserved some of that, he really rooted that out and began to install what was ultimately a completely impractical for normal purposes flower garden laid out on geometric bases that was actually very practical for him, both for his own well-being, but likewise for his art, because it really became the subject for so many paintings. And then across the road that cut at the end of his property, and then across a set of railroad tracks on which a train ran twice a day, he was able to purchase in 1893, 3 years later, a piece of property on which he constructed from scratch, once again, the water garden, which he was able to expand several times thereafter.
Derek Fell, this is really fascinating. I mean, we see the paintings. They are so beloved. They kind of define our understanding in many ways of Impressionism. Of course, he painted much more than gardens, but these are right at the heart of many people's impressions of Monet and Impressionism. And yet, to find then that it's not just the paintings he's creating here, but the garden beneath the painting, the garden that he's painting. Talk about he's perceiving and creating all in the same great cycle.
Right.
Here.
Well, really, his garden is an extension of his art. And I believe he's quoted as saying that his garden was his one and only masterpiece. Mm. And I would actually disagree with Paul in saying that he was not an artist first, he was a gardener first, because there is a quote saying that if it wasn't for flowers, he wouldn't be an artist. And he started life as a cartoonist. He took a liking to Impressionism because, of course, Impressionism is a form of exaggeration, which cartooning is also. But, he used the earth and the sky as his canvas, and he used plants as paint, not only to create color harmonies, but also to create what's called a shimmering effect, the Impressionist shimmer.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the Impressionist shimmer most noticeably in his paintings of the ocean or of lakes and streams. Because, of course, on a sunny day, when the wind whips the water, it creates these sparkles. And he wanted that sparkle generated in his garden. And A lot of people, when they plant white flowers in the garden, make the mistake of clumping them together. And that's too garish. It punches a hole in the landscape. Mm. So what Monet did, he planted flowers that have very airy kinds of sprays, and he salted them through the garden. And when you put white next to a strong, solid color like red or blue, you actually brighten that color. And that's why a lot of Monet's paintings are so bright and easy to admire, because he knew how to apply the paint and also how to enhance the paint with these little pinpricks of white. So, and he did that in the garden. Now, the other thing about Monet's garden, of course, are the color harmonies. He had certain colors that he liked to see in partnership with each other. For example, orange and violet is a common one that you see in the garden today. But I think his most fascinating is actually red, pink, green, and silver. And you might say, well, how do you get silver into the garden? Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of plants have gray leaves. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful painting that Monet did of a poppy field. And if you look at that painting very carefully, you'll see that the poppies are red and pink, the hillside is green, and on the edges of the hills, there is a silvery lavender or sage. And he got the idea of that color combination from nature. And he did with other things as well. It's interesting, actually, when you read a lot about Monet, you very often come across contradictions. And one of the contradictions I have found is that he hated black. Well, it's true that he didn't use black very often, but one of his most famous paintings, of course, is The Magpie, and it's a black and white bird sitting on a wattle fence in a garden that's covered in snow. And today, the gardeners at Giverny, in honor of that painting, they plant black and white color harmonies. And they do it by combining white flowers, sometimes with black, like black tulips, for example, or black pansies. But also they take a little liberty and they plant like maroon flowers, like maroon dahlias, to get that kind of extreme contrast that Monet liked in his paintings.
And there we began to get some of the clues to how you might make your own Monet garden if you've got vision and time and enthusiasm enough to do it. And many people do work on exactly that front. There's something just so magnetic about it. Paul Tucker, there's this chicken and egg question around garden and art, I guess. But were there other painters at that time? And we don't imagine Van Gogh going out and, you know, planting sunflowers and then drawing them. But were there others who were actually creating their own gardens in order then to paint them? I mean, it's a multi-step creation at that point, isn't it?
It's certainly true. And among the Impressionists and their followers, there really is no one like Monet. Certainly, Pizarro had his garden. It was a much more practical garden, and he did indeed paint it, but it really wasn't established as a kind of primary subject as a way which Monet operated. Obviously, Van Gogh painted plenty of gardens. Derek's written a wonderful book about that. Daubigny had his garden prior to Monet and the like. Mm. But this really was a unique creation. And in fact, it was also an outgrowth in many ways of his concern for painting in series, which really began in the 1890s in earnest.
Meaning
painting pictures of the exact same subject, mm-hmm. often from the same vantage point, under different light and weather conditions.
The haystacks and so on.
The stacks, mm-hmm. the poplars, the cathedrals, mornings on the Seine, and the mm-hmm. like, all of which earned him a fabulous amount of money, so that he actually was able to devote many of those funds to the acquisition of this land and to its maintenance. He, of course, had five gardeners, so it really was an expensive proposition. But the idea of painting a subject over and over again is something which is really unique to him. Certainly, artists had painted still lives, artists mm-hmm. had painted individual sites, but he really took it on and invented it, expanded it such that when it comes to the water lilies, which really dominate the 250 paintings that he made of his Giverny property, mm-hmm. You find him plumbing not only the extraordinary vastness of nature's magic, as Derek says, that sparkle on the water, the sense of movement of the water, the depths of the water, the reflections on the surface of the water and the like, but also the basic elements of his art, the shape of the canvas, the touch upon the surface, the combination of colors, all of which led to an exhibition in 1909 that was probably the most important show of the early 20th century. It was seen by everybody. It was a marvel that he was able to put in front of the public 48 paintings of his water garden, all of them different, yet all of them the same.
And these, a huge key to his success, he made a lot of money with them. He poured a lot of that money back into these gardens, and we are all heirs to the wonderment of the images that came from Monet's impressionism, his flowers, his gardens. Paul Tucker, please stand by in California. It is great to have you with us. Derek Fell in New York City. Listeners, you can join us. Do Monet's flowers speak to you on canvas in your backyard? Do you dream of floating away in that color and texture? Have you tried to recreate it in your own garden patch to make your own little Giverny? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the flowers of Claude Monet on canvas and in the dirt, about Monet's palette as impressionist painter and as gardener extraordinaire, his fine riot of flowers and more. It's planted to show off to great effect in month after month, different flowers coming to their zenith in each. In July, I'm reading here, in that garden there in Giverny, you'd have roses and nasturtium and zinnias and busy lizzies and dahlias, rudbeckias, salvia, gladiola, cosmos, sunflower, helianthus, hollyhocks, and of course just the beginning of the water lilies. Derek, Paul, we've got a lot of callers. Diane in Cary, North Carolina. Thank you for calling. Diane, you're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am an artist, and I have painted and taught in Monet's garden, and there is nothing like being there on location to paint and see what he saw. I feel like this is an extraordinary day for you because the speakers you have are filling in the missing links. They're filling in those things that Monet planted and how he planted it, why he planted it. I can tell you why he painted them, but I'm not going there. But I do want to add a couple neat things that discovered.
Diane. Yes. What do you see?
That I discovered in my learning of Monet's garden is that he, and you gentlemen may correct me if I'm wrong, but he collected seeds from his colleague painters. He collected seeds and plants from other countries, and he would try them in his garden. If they didn't work, they didn't work, and if they did, they were there. I know that in 1971-ish, up until that time, after Monet had passed on, the garden was left to go because the French didn't care much about it anymore. And it wasn't until an American woman from a major company picked up on it, and it has been brought back to its former beauty, along with his home.
That was Layla Etchison Wallace, by the way, of Reader's Digest magazine.
Layla Etchison Wallace of Reader's Digest magazine, the American woman you referred to, Diane.
Yes. In fact, most of the...
Sarah someone. But at any rate, the fact that he brought in and he tried so many things, he didn't just... Like, we can go to the store today and buy plants and seeds, but he practiced, and he brought in what would mean something to him.
Diane, let me ask you while I've got you. You've been there, it sounds like, many times. I've painted there. When you paint Monet's garden, do you make Monet's or do you make Diane's? You know what I mean? Does your impression come out the
same
as his?
Very good question to all painters out there in particular, is that I cannot be Monet, I don't want to be Monet because there's only one Monet. God created only one Monet.
Bravo, Diane.
Only one
Bravo.
Diane Johnson. And so all I can do is paint like I can paint. And and then when I teach there, I teach my students based on how their style is and what they want to extract from the garden and help them with their style, since I have painted and am familiar with a lot of different styles.
That's wonderful.
Actually, could I just interject
yes,
something here?
Yes, Derek.
You know, earlier there was a mention made of Monet, of Van Gogh painting gardens, but also Monet was very good friends with Renoir, and he was also very good friends with Cézanne. And both of their gardens in the south of France have been restored, and they're open to the public. Now, each of those people, Monet, Cézanne, and Renoir, were connected by Impressionism. But if you go to their gardens, you will see that their gardens are completely different from one another. They've injected their own personality and their own artistic style into those gardens.
Paint a picture of each for us, Derek. Paint a picture of each. If you go to Renoir or Cézanne in comparison to Monet's.
Yes. Okay, well, Renoir's garden is about the same size of Monet's, or at least it was. I think today it's shrunk a bit, but it's about 2.5 acres. Renoir was a conservationist, and he was horrified when he discovered that an orchard of 500-year-old olive trees was going to be demolished to make way for development. And he interceded in the sale and purchased it for himself. And his purpose was simply to paint the property, but his wife decided that she'd like to have a house there. And on a portion of the property that did not interfere with the orchard, they did in fact build a house. And Renoir used it to, of course, paint not only scenes of the garden, but Renoir, of course, is famous for his images of children and of women. And he actually built a studio outdoors, completely walled in glass, so that he could sit in comfort inside and he could seat his models out in the garden.
But did his garden have a distinctly different look and flavor from Monet's?
Yes, yes.
How so?
Well, Renoir, if you look at Monet's
garden, it wasn't
garden,
in Normandy, just to begin with. It was in the south, so it was a different climate,
yes.
I guess.
Yes, but if you look at Monet's garden, it's a garden that shows that Monet was in complete control of nature. Everything there, the straight lines of paths, it has a very formal appearance to begin with. And then the water garden is something different, and I'll explain that design philosophy later. But Monet's garden is very flowery, and Cézanne's garden is very spooky. It's very eerie. It's a shade garden. And what Cézanne painted mostly, or what he liked to paint mostly, was nature dominating man's dominion. In other words, reclaiming what man had spoiled.
Yeah.
And so he would go out into the countryside, and he'd love to find a farmhouse that was all going to ruin or whatever. And that would be his favorite motif, would be nature reclaiming man's dominion. And that's what his garden suggests, because it looks very wild. And you have ivy creeping up into the windows. And there are lots of leaf tunnels and lots of ivy and some spooky kinds of benches. And that was deliberate.
So there's a contrast. Derek, hold that thought. I want to bring it back to Paul for a moment, if I may.
All right.
Paul, to this kind of philosophical question here. I mean, here you have the great Impressionist, Monet. Not the only one, certainly, but he was pioneering here. And Impressionism, permitting, encouraging the artist to express his perception of nature. But then, if he's actually created that nature in the first place, how Impressionistic is it, Paul?
Well, it's a very good question, actually, Tom. And it intersects with Diane and the notion of if you are going to be painting something that is there in front of you and you have the history of art behind you, like all great artists do, how do you, in fact, find your own voice? Do you, in fact, represent all of those flowers with a kind of botanical accuracy, laying them down with a kind of touch that is also going to be true to those particular species? Or do you find some way to expand that language? And certainly Monet at the beginning is, and will continue all the way through, we can identify every plant that he paints. Mm-hmm. But if he wants to be able, like Cézanne and like Renoir, but even more, he wants to be able to inject a kind of significance into these paintings. Because in the end, paintings of his water lily pond in particular, since they dominate the mm-hmm. late work, could in fact be seen to be merely decorative pretty pictures. Mm-hmm. But he wants to be able to use that pond in a way to approach philosophical questions, Tom. He wants to be able to say, how do we understand things in the world? Look at the complexity of those paintings, what's underneath, what's on the surface, what's beyond, what's outside of the canvas. Mm-hmm. Think also, too, about the fact that here he's going to devote the last 26 years of his life until he dies in 1926 mm-hmm. at the ripe age of 86, painting yes. up to the very last moment, mm-hmm. to painting what is a kind of hortus conclusus, a kind of medieval garden that he himself is constructing. You ask the question, why? Well, one could say that in conjunction with his Impressionist colleagues, he is operating in a moment where Arcadia is a urge upon so many people of that culture, as exemplified in a fantastic exhibition presently at the Philadelphia Museum, that there is a understanding of our disconnection from nature. And while it is certainly true that in many paintings by Cézanne, nature is reclaiming its particular position, dominating man, there's a union that Cézanne wants from the two. And Monet does that as well. And on top of that, it's not just this kind of paradisial urge. It is for Monet a kind of moral act, because you have to recognize that he doesn't start painting his water lily garden until 1899. And that happens just after the horrible heinous Dreyfus affair in France, where the Jewish army captain Alfred mm-hmm. Dreyfus was wrongly accused of selling military secrets to the hated Prussians. It tore the country apart. Zola defended him. Monet wrote to Zola. Monet was a strident Dreyfusard, and it is a kind of recognition of his moral position for him to turn inwards and to paint what are essentially non-French subjects, i.e. the water lilies, over and over again, is a way for him to be able to say, this is how you should know yourself. You should, in fact, be able to look at even the small acreage of your own backyard, look deeply into nature, and be able to live responsibly.
A kind of almost Zen retreat in that from the world of political affairs? Is that what you're
both
suggesting?
Both Zen and public. He has feet in both camps mm-hmm. because, of course, he's very well connected to the Parisian world. Mm-hmm. That's why the Angerie actually comes to fruition after his death. But he's also somebody who reads the newspaper. He subscribed to press clipping services. He was in constant contact with Paris. So it's not completely a Zen-removed environment. It is when you look at the pictures, but they are created from this urge to be able to find a kind of 18th-century Jean-Jacques Rousseau sensibility that if you know yourself well enough, you can act properly in the world and set an example for others.
Derek Fell, how did the Japanese sensibility come into the water garden and the water lilies paintings? What was the origin of that for Monet?
Well, he wanted to extend his flower garden across the railroad tracks. He acquired another 2 acres. It was a swampy area, and he was able to dam a small stream, a tributary of the Seine, and create quite a large pond. In fact, it's almost a lake in its size. And the Clos Normand is really a kind of an English cottage garden in its plantings of flowers.
The other side of the road, the traditional garden.
And the paths are very long and straight. Mm-hmm. And when you are in the garden, especially on a misty morning, it looks like everything is disappearing into infinity. And so it's kind of an ordered garden. It's more of a traditional European garden. But the water garden is more of the Japanese aesthetic. And in the Japanese aesthetic, you have a garden design called a cup garden. And the cup garden is designed for introspection. In other words, the surface of the water becomes the bottom of your cup. Mm-hmm. And the sides of the cup become your marginal plantings around it. And, of course, Monet created what's called a Japanese stroll path that would go around the garden. And there would be viewpoints around the garden where you could admire the reflections on the water. So instead of looking out into the countryside along straight paths like you do in the flower garden, mm-hmm. here you're always looking in towards the reflections, and that's very contemplative.
And he's got
it's
bamboo and Japanese quince and cherry trees from Japan, but he'd never visited Japan. Was this from paintings that were popular in France at that time, or how did he get
the
vision?
Yes, it is, because he collected Japanese art, and he admired the Japanese artistic aesthetic. However, his water garden is not a Japanese garden. Mm-hmm. There are no bonsai subjects in it. There are no towers or lanterns or any kind of sculpture that you would see in a traditional Japanese garden. It's his interpretation of the Japanese aesthetic. And the only real Japanese element in that garden, apart from plants that come from Japan, mm-hmm. is, of course, the arched bridge. And that's probably the most iconic structure that people recognize of Monet's garden, is that beautiful green bridge, which originally he painted white. He wanted the colors of the sunsets and the times of the day to reflect on the white paint. But eventually he changed that, and he painted it apple green. And, in fact, every structure on the property, even the shutters of his house now, reflect that same color.
So how hard is it, Derek, to get the effect, never mind the water garden for a moment, but on the other side, in your gardens at Cedar Ridge? I mean, can you create that Monet look? Do you have a recipe, sort of a list of flowers, put them in and you'll have it? Or is it all about placement?
Oh, you can create it in a container. In fact, Monet was one of the first container gardeners that I can think of, because he loved to put plants in containers. And he would do, on a small scale, what he was also doing on a large scale, and that is making color harmonies and planting a little glitter in among those small plantings. But today, a home gardener can have a space 4 feet by 4 feet, and they can recreate a beautiful Monet color harmony. And that's what my book is about. I looked at Monet's garden as his greatest work of art, and I said to myself, why did he consider it his greatest masterpiece? And I present 100 reasons. Mm-mm. Some of these ideas that Monet had were completely original. Others, he took inspiration from some other garden or some other culture. He, for example, subscribed to Country Life magazine in England, and Gertrude Jekyll was their famous columnist at that time.
Derek Fell, hold the thought. We have to take a short break right here. We'll come back and look much more high philosophy and in-the-dirt gardening. We're talking this hour about the flowers of Claude Monet with Derek Fell and Paul Tucker. You can join us. What's the secret to the Monet effect? What colors, what flowers, what combinations, and what makes one garden a plot and the other a Monet? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the flowers of Claude Monet on canvas and in the garden, about Monet's palette as impressionist painter and as gardener extraordinaire, with that fine riot of flowers, the water lilies, and so much more. And Derek, Paul, lots of feedback from our listeners. Jennifer writes to us on Facebook, says, my husband David and I are avid gardeners, also greatly admire Monet and his works. They're in Jamestown, Rhode Island. So recently we've been putting our focus on our hostas, which we planted outside our glass studio. Greens, whites, lavender, and a special touch of silver. Thank you, Monet. And here's another from Alren. She says, I enjoy wild-growing, semi-organized color patches of flowers that show me surprises The flowers and plants have taken the place of our lawn and bring us great joy. She says, but this dry summer, her garden is so thirsty. Derek, we associate that kind of, I don't know, organized chaos with Monet's groupings of flowers a little bit, don't we?
Well, yes, that's an important point, actually, because he called the soul of his garden wildflowers. Now, in a lot of other books about Monet's garden, there are contradictions that are not true. For example, one book I recall says he hated hybrids. Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, the garden could not be what it is unless he had hybrids. And in fact, he visited hybridizers even in Holland and in England in order to have the latest varieties. But he tempered the effect of those hybrids, which usually have bigger flowers and they're more flamboyant. He tempered them with wildflowers. He went out into the countryside and he collected seed from foxgloves and poppies and oxeye daisies and all the other things that grow in the French countryside. And he brought them into his garden and he scattered them among his hybrid irises and his hybrid dahlias and all the other hybrids he had. And that gave that unusual kind of wild effect later on in the season.
And, of course, he couldn't have had the water lilies, as you rightly point out, Derek, without the hybrids. It was 1889 that Latour Mauriac was able to exhibit in the World's Fair of 1889 these new hybrid versions
That's
of
true.
The water lilies, which I might add for Massachusetts listeners, were based upon a number of different hardier versions, and one of which came from Cape Cod.
Yes, it did. He got the pink from Cape Cod. He got the red from Sweden. And he found a yellow in Mexico. And he crossed those colors. But here's an interesting anecdote about that gentleman, Marliac. His nursery is still exists today in the south of France near Burgundy. And he was invited by the Royal Horticultural Society to give a lecture about his breeding. And he did not want British nurserymen competing with him and copying his work. So he misled them. His entire lecture was based on untruths.
Wow.
he actually claimed that the breeding work was done by crossing hardy water lilies with tropicals. And that is genetically impossible, we know today.
You know, Paul, I'm still trying to resolve in all this, especially as you and Derek describe his, you know, his collecting and his breeding and his half dozen gardeners working for him throughout the year or the season to make it look just right. And yet you quote Monet, Paul, saying, "I am following nature without being able to grasp her." Seems like he grasped her plenty here. I mean, he was the creator of the scene itself, Paul.
Well, this is true, but he had a humility in front of nature like so many of these artists. Cézanne, in his last year of 1906, writes a moving letter to his son saying, "I'm just beginning to understand nature and its processes." So they are deeply rooted in a 19th century kind of romantic sensibility that is united with a keen urgency, a kind of botanical scientific desire to capture the world in these paints, many of which, of course, were new in the 19th century as well. And that humility is also, I think, a part of the ways in which he conceived of his art, an art that is going to be accessible to all, an art that is not going to have the kind of interiority and complexity or apparent interiority and complexity that someone like Cézanne has, even though it's deep and rich in all of that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it also is part of his legacy, meaning that he is perhaps one of the most sought-after and popular artists around the world. And I think that sense that he is only beginning to understand what he is up to is a kind of invitation for all of us to admire his extraordinary handiwork.
Let's go to Sally in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Sally, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that a few years back, I had the opportunity to go to a show of my great-grandfather's in Giverny. Was early spring, and we got to go to Monet's garden, and it was pouring rain and misty, but pretty magical.
Your great-grandfather's work was being shown there? What was it? Was he a painter, sculptor, what, Sally?
He was an American Impressionist.
And the name again?
Twachtman.
Twachtman.
Oh.
John Henry Twachtman.
That's fantastic because, of course, the Americans invaded Giverny in the 1880s, Falkman and others, so much so, as you probably know, Sally,
yes,
that Monet even began to contemplate leaving Giverny because there were so many Americans. And then the terrible thing was that his eventual stepdaughter married one, which was something of a setback from Monet's point of view.
But he allowed other painters to come into his Giverny and paint it? That was no problem to him, Paul?
Well, he didn't own the whole town.
You mean they came to town, but not his garden? Or
that's right.
Actually,
I have
a very good anecdote about the American Impressionists. Mm-hmm. One of them was Metcalf, Willard Metcalf.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first, and he rode into Giverny on a bicycle. And he knocked on Monet's door and had the audacity to ask Monet if he could paint his flower garden. And, of course, Monet had six stepdaughters, and each of them were interested in getting married. And here's this handsome American, so he invites him in for lunch and introduces him to his daughters. And then afterwards, he says to Metcalf, look, you can't paint my flower garden because I'm the only one allowed to do that.
Okay.
But my vegetable garden is looking quite nice right now. Why don't you, Blanche, take him to the vegetable garden and show him what I mean?
We'll see you later.
Now, the vegetable garden was full of peonies. He didn't want to waste space in his flower garden growing peonies because he loved to fill the whole house with them because they're very fragrant.
Yes.
But he didn't mind them occupying space in his vegetable garden. Now, that painting came on the market a few years ago, and I bid on it, and I own it now.
Wow. Wow. All kinds of Americans climbing into town and some right into the vegetable garden. Harry in Burlington, Vermont. Harry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hello, Harry. You're on.
Yes. I have a question because, first of all, I love your depth. I think they're great.
Me
and
too.
I love the insights, specifically about sort of Monet's late life philosophy and the way he thought about his own work and how it affected nature and the surroundings. But
mm-hmm.
I'm curious also what your guests think about his blindness, because if he had that sort of humility for nature and the natural world, did he have the same sort of respect for the natural sort of, you know, a decay of his own vision? Was that sort of a curiosity that he welcomed in his work and his life as he went blind?
Harry, I'm
no. He was absolutely profoundly concerned about it all. But it is an issue of keen interest and often, I think, overextended, Harry, because he was diagnosed with cataracts in 1912 in both eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They began to deteriorate. It's often said quite falsely that his late work is blurry because his eyesight was going bad. It's simply not the case. It was a conscious aesthetic decision. But he did have cataract operation in one of his eyes in 1923, and he was terrified because, of course, his whole life was based upon his eyes. He recovered from that, to make the short story very short. He recovered from it. In the end, it was fine, despite all the trauma. And those last pictures, his great masterpiece, really, the Angerie, the two rooms with their full wall paintings in both those elliptical spaces, are the product of this energy of a man who was in full command of his form and certainly was able to celebrate the fact that he was still able to see.
Paul, we have another listener who asks not about limitations on his sight, but whether it was kind of extraordinary. A listener writes on Twitter that says, I had heard that Monet saw some of the ultraviolet spectrum, which is why his paintings have a distinct hue. Did he have superpowers of sight? I don't know.
There was a critic who in the 1880s was talking about the violetomania of Impressionism,
mm-hmm.
that somehow or other all of these painters somehow or other had this kind of infection of their eyes to be able to see the spectrum in some kind of curious and unacceptable manner. He certainly had an enormously effective eye. Being here in California, just looking out at the landscape and trying to be able to determine exactly how this light functions, I wish that Monet was here by my side because he'd be able to tell me exactly what color to be using, because he was so sensitive to that from the very beginning of his career. Yes, indeed, inspired by flowers, but inspired by this urgency that he had within him to be able to be one with nature and to replicate it in paint.
Julian in North Andover, Massachusetts. Julian, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a question. I spent some time myself working in a garden in France called the Jardin d'Art et d'Essai. It was very much modeled after these impressionist gardens of, you know, Monet, Renoir, and Cézanne. And the woman who owned this garden, the gardening practices she had to adopt and the relationship with the land around her ended up consuming her lifestyle. So I was wondering if your guest could speak a little bit to the gardening practices and attitude towards the earth that Monet ended up cultivating as a result of his fascination with gardening and how those affected his lifestyle.
Lovely. We'll do it. Derek Fell, what do you say?
Well, I have commented on his color harmonies, which he took from nature mostly, and also the shimmering effect that he introduced to his garden. But also in the garden today, they actually try to recreate the actual varieties that Monet used. And in fact, he did develop, he himself and his sons developed a hybrid, a poppy, which has been lost to cultivation, and they're still trying to find examples of it to bring back into the garden. But I know that one of the interesting varieties that Monet used was a Pennsylvania rose. It was bred by a doctor, and it was introduced into cultivation by Conard Pyle, the Rosarians. And they exhibited the new rose called American Pillar. It was a climber. Mm. At the Bagatelle test trials, and it won a gold medal. And Monet was very friendly with the gardener, and the gardener gave him cuttings, and he planted that American Pillar rose all over the garden, and it's still there today. It's the most prominent rose you will see in that garden.
And Derek, what about, if I may, its imprint on his life? I mean, our Julian calling in here says, you know, the French garden owner that he worked for ended up, sounds rather consumed by her garden, its effect on her life was deep, and of course we know gardens can do that. What about that
yes.
aspect, even with all the... five, six, seven gardeners he had working with him.
Well, he was passionate about gardening. And the passion shows through, especially in his correspondence with Caillebotte. Caillebotte was an impressionist painter who was very wealthy. And the two of them were very interested in horticulture and speaking botanical names and introducing to each other plants. And Monet would write to Caillebotte and say, come at 2:00 on Monday. That's when my irises will be at their peak. And
wow.
He meant it. Wow. I mean, he knew the precise time of day that those flowers were going to be at their best. And, I mean, there are wonderful anecdotes, too, of him visiting England. And in fact, I spoke with a lady in her hundreds who actually saw Monet going through trial gardens, making notes in his notepad and taking them back so that he could create these wonderful color harmonies. But he was the first vertical gardener. I mean, he made these trellises and these immense archways, and he wanted his entire field of vision filled with color. Like when you walk into a woodland,
yes.
You don't see a whole patch of sky. You see everything in shades of green. He wanted to see everything in shades of color, no matter whether he was looking at the ground or whether he was looking at the sky.
That is bold. That is bold. Paul Tucker, take us back once more into his philosophy, sort of the heart of it here. If we want to plant with Monet hands or see with Monet eyes, what does that mean?
Well, I think it really means a kind of sensitivity to everything in the world. And I say everything in the world. And, of course, that's almost impossible because it's an overload. But as Derek describes, Monet's world was a kind of sensory overload. And in that kind of immersion in the breadth of color, in the sweetness of the nectars and aromas and the winds whistling through all of that foliage, there is a sense of truly being alive. And being alive is, in part, of course, is all-consuming, as Julian says, being alive at every moment in that garden, both of the gardens, the flower and the water garden, reminds us of the value of life, which is, of course, for Monet, going to be evident in the flowers themselves and in his paintings. And the fact, I think Julian's question is really very poignant, because he was consumed with these gardens for 26 years. From more or less 1904 onwards, he never painted anything else except for one small group of pictures of a town of Vétoy down the Seine. Mm-hmm. Other than that, he spent his entire time on it. And I think it reminds us of the power of that place. It reminds us of Monet's constant sense of trying to push him to new levels and to open painting up to new possibilities, and to remind us also of our humanity in front of nature.
Well, on this midsummer day, it's an inspiration to us just to have it in our mind's eye, not to say the glory of being able to look at it. I should remind our listeners, at our website you can see a wonderful collection of Monet paintings, of Derek Fell photographs, just extraordinary, quite wonderful, as well as, and you can add to if you like, a little album of our listeners' flower gardens there. This has been really a delight. Derek Fell, author of The Magic of Monet's Garden and The Impressionist Garden, writes the Avant Gardener newsletter and gardens at Cedar Ridge Farm in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Derek Fell, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, really.
And Paul Tucker at the University of Massachusetts Boston, curator of Monet's Garden in New York. Thank you, Paul. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.